Welcome to South Sudan in Focus. I'm the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program, Very Remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, July 27, 2021. Authorities in Lakes and Warab states deny ordering extrajudicial killing of criminals in the area.
Yeah, I read the press yesterday, and I know it's baseless. I don't think there is any sense in it, because there is no report from our security forces on the ground of anyone killed arbitrarily.
And senior officials in Jonglei State reconcile and agree to work together.
So I don't think that even if we fight, I believe that later on we can talk about it, and we can figure out why we fight.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Lake state officials are denying they authorized any extrajudicial executions in the state. The United Nations mission in South Sudan issued a statement Monday expressing concern about what it called a series of extrajudicial killings in Lakes and Warab states. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Between March and June of this year, ANMI says its human rights division documented incidents in which a total of 42 people were arbitrarily killed in Lakes and Warab states. In some cases, suspected criminals were pulled out of prison and executed without being sentenced by a court, according to the ANMI's statement. ANMIS is urging authorities to immediately put a stop to all extrajudicial killings. A special representative of the UN Secretary General, Nicolas Asom, called the extrajudicial executions deeply disturbing, according to the statement. People accused of crimes have the right to a fair trial as part of a formal judicial process. They should not be subjected to the random judgment of government or traditional leaders that they should be taken out and shot in front of their families and communities, said Haysom. ANMI says eyewitness accounts describe suspects being taken to remote areas and tied to trees, then executed by firing squad. After they are dead, their bodies are left on the trees as a way to frighten the communities from committing crimes. Lake State Deputy Governor Paul Madit denies any extrajudicial killings are carried out in his state.
Yeah, I read the press yesterday, and I know it's baseless. I don't think there is any sense in it, because there is no report from our security forces on the ground of anyone killed arbitrarily. Reports I get every day are reports of criminals who are apprehended, taken to police custody. The UN needs to really substantiate their reports. Otherwise, as a state government, we are not aware of what they say.
Madit admits that at times security forces in the state have clashed with armed criminals who refuse to submit to police arrest.
So many of our security forces have died in the hands of civilians, and the security forces didn't have any law to protect themselves with. So what I do understand by that law is that the security forces have the mandate to kill anyone who fires shots at them, because civilians are armed, and if we send the security forces to enforce the law and order, they attack and kill them.
Lakes State has seen some of the worst intercommunal clashes in recent months, which have left hundreds of people dead and hundreds more injured. Madit admits an incident when police in Lakes State extrajudicially killed a suspected criminal.
I know of one instance, and if that is what ANMIS has magnified, maybe that is it, of a criminal who killed a woman and a child, and when the security forces attempted to arrest him, that was in mid-June, no, the first week of June actually, he fired shots at them.
Madit says security forces shot back and killed the gunman. In June, President Salva Kiir fires Lakes State Governor Matur Kulang, replacing him with General Rintuen Mabur in an effort to help restore peace and stability across the restive state. During his first few days as governor, Mabur convened a meeting of all Lakes State leaders, chiefs, youth and women to consult them on what could be done to stop intercommunal violence and road ambushes in Lakes State. Most of the participants recommended shooting criminals on sight as the best solution. And Ms. Bose Asom says extrajudicial killings are not a solution to restoring law and order in Lakes State or anywhere else. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The Jonglei State Governor and his deputy have vowed to reconcile after engaging in bitter dispute. This came about after the United Nations mission in South Sudan sponsored a three-day conference last week that brought together the governor, his deputy, and other state officials to talk about challenges affecting good governance. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
The row between Governor Dinay Jok Chagur and his deputy Antipas Nyong Kucha began in March after Chagur appointed Gadwich Kwok as the State Secretary General, and Agon Aliera as Bor Town Mayor without consulting Kucha. The deputy governor says under the key principles articulated in the revitalized peace agreement, Chagur was supposed to consult Kucha before making any appointments. Kucha says he nominated Angong Kualtir for Bor Town Mayor, who was not appointed. Chagur is from the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, while his deputy Kucha is from the SPLM party. The 2018 peace deal does not spell out in detail how the two positions shall be shared among the parties in the state. In April, Kucha fired Bor Town Mayor Aliere and dismissed him from the SPLM party, accusing him of colluding with the governor to be appointed mayor illegally. The next day, Chagur reinstated Aliere as mayor. Since that time, the two leaders are rarely seen at public events shaking hands together. Last week's Animus conference brought together Governor Chagur, Kucha, state advisors, ministers and heads of commissions and county commissioners with the aim of reconciling the two state leaders. Professor Julie Akirduan, the former vice-chancellor of Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology, who helped facilitate the forum, urged the governor and his deputy to reconcile. Duan says the two leaders should move beyond their differences for the sake of Jonglei State citizens.
You were a leader, you should do two things. Have time with everybody. And when you lead everybody, you remember that time you have spent with them. And for us, as in Jonglei, we want the time our two leaders spent here, the memorable time we can all remember. We have good time during the night chapel and Ambassador Nyong, with the team, the ministers, the commissioners, all of you spend a good time, from the top to the bottom.
Isidore Bushwe, the head of the Animus office in Jonglei State, says the goal of the conference was not only to reconcile the governor and his deputy, but to offer some guidance on their roles as stipulated in the 2018 revitalized peace agreement.
They are taking seriously the position and the role they have to play to bring this country to another state. Thank you. I hope the train will reach the destination in 2 days, because here is the start. We are just starting. In this regard, personally, as the head of field office and with my colleagues from the UN, will continue engaging with the governor and deputy governor to work on pertinent issues that can bring us in the implementation of the plan we developed during this forum.
Kucha says he is willing to reconcile and improve relations with the governor.
When agreements are worked out, they are easy to be signed, but the details of implementation are not that easy. And we have experience of the implementation of the comprehensive peace agreement with the government of Khartoum from 2005 to 2011. So please, thank you for those few points, and we will try our level best who make use of some of the factual information which some of us might have been lacking regarding the implementation of the peace agreement and regarding the relationship between the various government officials.
For his part, Governor Chagur promised to find amicable ways to resolve any confusion hindering the political progress in his state.
This is the time where we have to interact with ourselves, where I'm going to understand you, and you're going to understand me. This is how I look at it. And this is why you see me sitting here. Even if we're going to go for another 3 more days, I would have been here. In South Sudan in general, we have one thing that is a problem that people don't talk about more enough. I believe that I can understand somebody as long as we speak the same language. And I believe that people can understand me if they can hear me. I do believe that. So I also think that even if we fight, I believe that later on we can talk about it and we can figure out why we're fighting.
Governor Chagur urged all Jonglei state and local officials to put behind their differences, party ideologies, and individual disagreements in the interest of the people and adhering to the revitalized peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
From Jonglei State, we go to Japan, where South Sudan runner Angelina Lohalit is set to compete in Tokyo Games as part of expanded Olympic refugee team. She made her Olympic debut at the Games in Rio. And as VOA's Gwen Uten reports, Lohalit hopes to run the 1,500 meters race faster than expected.
In 2016, track runner Angelina Nadai Lohalit was one of 10 athletes to compete at the Rio Games as part of the first ever Olympic refugee team. Now the 26-year-old is set to compete for a second time at this year's Tokyo Games. And just days before the opening ceremony, Lohalit told Reuters News she had a dream of seeing the world, but wasn't sure how she would achieve it until she became an Olympian.
I used to tell myself that one time I will travel with the aeroplane in various places, but I never knew that what will make me to travel. I just know that one time I'm going to travel. But now it happened in 2016 that I traveled to Brazil and competed international Olympic. Then I realized that, I have a talent that can take me far. For me, I was really, really happy for it.
Lohalit was preparing to travel again, this time to Tokyo, as one of 5 refugees originally from South Sudan who competed in Rio. But then the pandemic hit, forcing her to leave her training camp for a refugee camp in Kakuma in northeast Kenya. Lohalit had previously lived at the camp after she escaped South Sudan's civil war in 2002, and she says putting her Olympic dreams on hold last year and returning to Kakuma took a mental and physical toll.
The time when COVID-19 broke, we went home to refugee camps almost now a year. So our good ship that we were, it went down. So by that time, you know, now being in the refugee camp, most of the time it is challenging. It's not a kind of a good place that you can train with. First of all, it was because of the weather. Then the place is not, sometimes it's not safe for training. But then we never lose hope. I never lose hope because I know there's something ahead of me. It is not something that happened to me only. It happened to the whole world.
The delayed games caused a disruption in Lohalit's training, and to get back into competitive shape, she trained for 1 hour on the track in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, and she leaned on her natural talent for running that was discovered in high school. A teacher encouraged Lohalit to take part in a race that was founded by Kenyan long-distance runner Tegla Larupe. Larupe is a former marathon world record holder and currently chief of mission for the IOC's Olympic refugee team. And ahead of the Tokyo Games, she expressed pride at seeing her team of athletes on the Olympic stage.
It is a teamwork to see that kids with a displaced background have the right to compete like any other. So today our athletes are athletes, not like when they went to Rio. Now they are competing because of time.
LaRupe was also on her way to Tokyo, but she tested positive for COVID-19 just days before the start of the Games. It's being reported she will not travel to Japan. However, Angelina Lohalith is in Tokyo, where she says she hopes to run even faster than she ran at the Rio Games. In 2016, she finished the 1500-meter race with a time of 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Now, Lohalith hopes to cut her time in that same event to under 4 minutes 30 seconds.
I'm really now struggling to reduce some second, but if I can just run under 30, I know it for me it will be a big achievement for me.
The women's 1500 meter qualifying heats are scheduled to begin on Sunday. This year's refugee team is nearly 3 times larger than the inaugural team in 2016. The team of 29 athletes are from 11 countries that include Cameroon, Congo, Republic of Congo, Eritrea, Sudan, and South Sudan. Per tradition, the country of Greece led the parade of athletes during last Friday's opening ceremony, but following close behind were the members of the refugee team, banded together under the white Olympic flag. For South Sudan in Focus, I'm Gwen Uten in Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, how is the violence in South Africa affecting the image of the country? That story is coming up right after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Describe a perfect day.
A perfect day is when I wake up in the morning without any challenges. I have my family around me. I go to work, come back without any mishaps or difficulties or any hangovers.
A perfect day for me would be a day without any stress, without traffic, without any sickness, without any pertinent need. That would be a perfect day for me.
My perfect day, when I get off and then I come out, I do all my assignment in the office or in the other aspect of my curriculum activities.
Maybe watching movies so I could fall asleep, you know, just watch something for laughs, a comedy, and that's just my typical perfect day.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we can all help fight the corona pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and nose when we are in crowded places or areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. And in our Tuesday Health segment, we look at the future of pandemics. The number of known deaths from the COVID-19 has passed 4 million. That's according to Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking both cases and deaths. In the past 100 years, there have been flu and cholera pandemics, the AIDS pandemic, and other multiple diseases around the world. VOA's Carol Pearson says the latest research shows many pandemics either don't have to happen or can be contained.
As some countries prepare for yet another wave of the coronavirus, doctors in countries with a surplus of vaccines are begging people to get vaccinated.
I'm Dr. Michael Boulding. I've been working our COVID unit for the last 16 months. I get asked on a daily basis now what our COVID unit looks like.
Boulding says he is now seeing very sick, unvaccinated patients in their 20s and 30s.
With no comorbid conditions. Ending up on ventilators, BiPAP, high-flow oxygen, and extremely sick, sicker than at any time during this pandemic.
With a vaccine, severe illness and death from COVID-19 can be avoided. Amanda McClelland works to prevent epidemics at an organization called Resolve to Save Lives.
We're calling for a global goal of 717. 7 days to detect an outbreak, 1 day to notify an outbreak, and 7 days to mount an effective response.
VOA interviewed Amanda McClelland at a summit on disease prevention and control. She says it's possible to prevent epidemics and cites Uganda as an example. Uganda stopped a recent Ebola outbreak at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Uganda responded to the risk and mobilized their communities, mobilized their health systems to strengthen surveillance along the border and was able to detect Ebola cases and care for those patients effectively, and they didn't have an Ebola outbreak.
In fact, a study released in April by Resolve to Save Lives that's called Epidemics That Didn't Happen included multiple examples of situations where countries avoided or stopped epidemics. Here's another example. In 2014, Nigeria stopped an Ebola outbreak, and in 2016, Brazil prevented a yellow fever epidemic from taking hold. In both cases, health officials implemented coordinated response activities, effective communication, and dedicated leadership. McClellan says the key is good leadership and building trust at the community level.
You can't just come when something bad happens. You have to be there all of the time. You have to meet the communities where they are and address their everyday health needs, and that builds trust.
McClelland says trust, good journalism, and a strong civil society help communities push back against disinformation and politicizing diseases, vaccines, and treatments. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Some of the South Africa's most political thinkers say many in the international community are unfairly writing the country off in the wake of recent public violence. Looting and destruction of property in parts of two provinces followed the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma for his refusal to testify at an inquiry into alleged corruption during his tenure between 2009 and 2018. One analyst says her country should be respected for the way it handled the crisis. For VOA News, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
As a woman in her mid-20s, Melanie Verwoerd was elected as a member of South Africa's first democratic parliament in 1994. She was a powerful symbol of a new South Africa, a young white Afrikaner woman who supported Nelson Mandela's mostly black ruling African National Congress, or ANC. She was also related by marriage to the man despised by most citizens as the grand architect of apartheid, former white supremacist Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd. She says the recent unrest in South Africa has largely been portrayed around the world as a country going up in flames, when in reality it was confined to parts of only two provinces.
People almost waited all these years for South Africa to go the way that so many other developing or African countries in particular go. That did not happen, and it's really important to say that. There was a challenge here. There was a boil that burst.
The elements in that festering boil, says Verwoerd, are poverty, inequality, and mass unemployment, exploited by Zuma's supporters to cause as much chaos as possible, to perhaps even topple the government. She says the plan failed because of the leadership of President Cyril Ramaphosa.
He came in for a lot of flak, but in my view, it was really important to have a cool-headed leader like him during this time. If we had a trigger-happy, dominating, patriarchal type of leader, we would have seen a lot more deaths and the thing would have escalated. Instead, what it did is he...
Just like in 1994, Verwoerd maintains the race war, often predicted for South Africa, didn't happen.
the people of the country came together across racial lines. This did not end up becoming a big racial fight in South Africa. The fact that it was taxi drivers who went into townships and said, you will not loot. It was people who came across the racial lines and set up roadblocks. And ultimately, that's now people across the racial lines who are cleaning up the country.
She says her fellow citizens should feel bizarrely proud about passing one of their most serious tests since 1994, because if ever there was a time when South Africa could have exploded, it was now.
I do believe that in a way the world should actually look at South Africa in awe and say that despite what happened in the last week and a half, 2 weeks, that we could pull ourselves back as a country from the abyss and not, you know, not...
Verwoerd says South Africa is a special country because it deals with so many modern global challenges.
We deal with the issues of inequality, we deal with the racial challenges and diversity, we deal with the issues of a very fragmented and problematic past, and then we deal with all the other issues like climate change, pandemic, etc., on the same level, perhaps even just more on steroids because we do not have enough economic power to buffer the fallouts of it. And thus it is important always.
In this context, says Verwoerd, the world will continue to look at and learn from South Africa's reaction to crises such as the recent violence. She says the country's long been a global symbol of both horror and hope, and this isn't going to change anytime soon. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
South Sudanese artists gathered today in Juba to mourn one of their colleagues who died in northern Uganda over the weekend in a road accident. The body of South Sudanese rapper Muriel Alex, who is popularly known as Matani, was brought to Juba today for prayers and final burial. South Sudan has indeed lost a young talent whose music has changed lives. We extend our condolences to his family and the music industry in South Sudan. We now leave you with Matani and the song Anayao Barif. Listening to Late Matani with the song Anayao Barif. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Galile, who wanna shaka?